Dr. Alan Frizzetti is an associate professor of psychology and director of the Dialectical Behavior Therapy Research Program at University of Nevada in Reno. He received his PhD in University of Seattle, where he was directly involved with Marsha Linehan's work on her first randomized controlled trial, which then led to the book that was published on DBT. And he's remained one of the foremost experts in DBT. He's published many articles and chapters on DBT, and his book, The High Conflict Couple, applies DBT principles to couples therapy. I'll also point out that Dr. Frizzetti is the research director and a member of the board of directors for the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder, and he co-developed with Perry Hoffman the Family Connections Program that I refer to in my talk and that you'll be hearing about more later. Please help me welcome Dr. Frizzetti.
Thanks so much, Seth. And first, of course, a thank you to Seth and Perry and Anthony for putting this together, and to the MBT and DBT experts for being here, and of course to all of you for coming and participating in this conference. I wanted to say that after listening to Anthony this morning, and I've had the pleasure of listening to Anthony quite a few times, I actually had an insight. It was a failure of mentalizing that led me to be here and actually to be a DBT therapist. Because 24 or 5 years ago, I was waiting for a patient, and Marsha Linehan, who of course developed DBT, was also waiting for a patient. And Marsha said to me, "You're just the person I want to see." And I actually, my mentalizing failure was that I thought she was actually interested in me. And instead of actually me being the only warm body within 100 yards. So that failure led me to, of course, then start doing DBT. So that's an interesting, happy accident. So it's my pleasure to talk about DBT here this morning, and especially to be able to continue this discussion into the afternoon and do some demonstration later on. But right now what I want to do for the next hour or so, or maybe a bit less, is to give you an overview of what DBT is. I'm going to try to accomplish a little bit of each of these 6 things, talk a little bit about the evidence, a little bit about the theory that underpins DBT, something about the structure of treatment, the dialectics, the core theoretical principle here of acceptance and change, something about skill deficits that people have, that have BPD, and how we see skills as solutions, and something about the processes of change in the therapy itself, both inside and outside of the session. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on patient outcomes. Seth, I think, did a very nice job highlighting these, but I do want to say that DBT outcomes have been especially strong in a variety of domains, but not just the main, what we think of as the getting patients stable. I think sometimes because DBT is so good at helping people get stable, we sometimes think that's all that DBT does. But in fact, that's the start. We have a staged treatment, so we start with stability, but we actually move on to other things like improving social functioning, reducing anger, global improvements, reducing other clinical disorders like panic attacks, PTSD, depression, and so forth. And DBT is actually quite good at reducing dropout or increasing retention. You know, over the 15 or so randomized clinical trials and several dozen treatment studies in general, DBT dropout is about 20% over the course of a year compared to 40 to 65% in treatments in the community. So quite a dramatic difference. And just to give you an example of what these outcomes look like, this is a recent trial that we've completed with young adults in DBT. 12 months of treatment. This includes the 12-month treatment period and a follow-up period. And you can see these are decreases in suicidality, DBT, compared to an object relations psychodynamic psychotherapy. Significant improvements in both, but more significant in DBT. On depression, not a trivial variable, because depression co-occurs with BPD perhaps 75 to 85% of the time. And here you can see both groups start with quite high levels of depression. The psychodynamic condition does quite well, reducing depression to a mean of about 15, 16 at the end, DBT down to around 8 at the end. And that, by the way, on this particular scale, 10 is considered the cutoff. Below 10, you're considered non-depressed. So these are, on average, quite good outcomes. And if you think about global assessment of functioning, the GAF scale or Access 5 on the DSM, these are all folks who are starting around 50. There's a range, of course. Psychodynamic conditioning, again, does rather well with scores at the end going up an average of almost 15 points, but in DBT up into the high 70s. So really rather dramatic average scores. Of course, these averages reflect a range, and some people who are doing extremely well, quite into the normal high-functioning range, some people in the mid-range, and so forth. APA Division 12 has criteria for establishing treatments as conditionally effective, maybe effective, controversial, and so forth. And DBT is considered well-established by the American Psychological Association. Sometimes people say, well, gee, maybe there are some common factors. This is one of the nice things I think about talking about DBT and talking about mentalization, is that it's pretty clear that from the data that it's not just common factors, not just good therapy, actually, that leads to outcomes, because there's plenty of good therapy in the comparison conditions, uncontrolled treatment as usual, client-centered psychotherapy, expert treatment as usual therapy, or good object relations therapy. There's plenty of good generic therapy in those therapies, and DBT has outperformed them. So there clearly are specific factors, and the so-called Dodo-Bird hypothesis that all treatments are good and all should have prizes really ought to be extinct. It's our job to try to identify those specific factors, and I think that's what's fun about this conference, is we're going to maybe start to get at what those specific factors are and where in DBT and MBT some of those specific factors might be the same and where those specific factors might be different. One of the interesting things we haven't talked about so much is cost savings. And this is important because for people who are in long-term treatment, who are suicidal and have problems with stability, it can be quite expensive, whether it's a public health system like in the UK or private systems here in the U.S. It's expensive to the system, to families, to patients, insurance companies, and so forth. And now it's been replicated several times that DBT costs about half as much as doing comparison treatments, or to put it differently, not doing DBT. That savings comes primarily from many, many fewer inpatient visits, emergency room medical utilization kinds of things. That savings, of course, compounds over time. It's not just during the treatment year, but it compounds into more savings down the road. One of the things that I think we might have fun talking about this afternoon is provider satisfaction, the satisfaction on the part of the therapist, or the flip side of that, trying to reduce burnout. Now, there aren't any studies about in which we can randomly assign providers. It's not that easy to do. You can't randomly assign. Well, you could, but who's going to volunteer to be randomly assigned? Okay, I'm going to spend the next couple of years learning MBT, or the next couple of years learning some other treatment, or the next couple of years learning DBT, and then you're going to do that in a trial and see really how happy you are as a therapist. I mean, I don't think too many therapists are going to volunteer for that mission. So what we can do, which is not as good, but we can look at what happens over time from before learning DBT to after learning DBT and into subsequent years. And indeed, therapists report lower burnout and increased job satisfaction from pre to post training in DBT in community health centers and forensic settings. Now, what do we conclude from that? Well, because there's no ability to have a comparison group here, all we can conclude is that learning DBT isn't hazardous to your health. And that's good. It's a good starting place. But what we do know is that provider satisfaction, or the flip side, not burning out, actually overall in psychotherapy predicts better patient outcomes, and better patient outcomes predicts higher satisfaction. So there's a kind of loop that we can engage here by keeping therapists from burning out. And I think my impression is that there's a lot of that in MBT. There's a lot going on there to keep therapists from burning out as well. That might be a similarity. Okay, so let's briefly talk about the theory that undergirds DBT. First of all, Seth talked about emerging changes in the DSM-5, and I'm not sure where that's going to go. I think that the DSM sometimes has rather nicely been compared to the camel that's a horse that went through a committee. unfortunately, when you have a DSM-3 and then a 4 and a 4R and then a 5, then the CAML goes through a committee. What's that going to look like? It's, I don't know how much it's going to look like the original horse. That's a big problem, I think, for those of us who work closely with people with these kinds of problems. But within DBT, the label that we give it isn't so important. What's important is we understand borderline personality disorder, what it's called in 2011 anyway, is borderline personality disorder, is a pervasive dysfunction of the emotion dysregulation system. That's how we think about it. And we're clearly, whatever the label, we're going to have people who have pervasive problems with their emotion dysregulation system in 2014 after the DSM-5 comes out. So whoever those people are, whatever we call them, I don't know what that's going to be, we'll still treat them. So you may not have borderline personality disorder anymore by fiat, but you might still have problems of dysregulation. I do want to point out that dysregulation is actually a little bit more complicated to understand than you might think. It's not the same as high arousal, okay? It's not the same as being upset. One can have a lot of emotion, be very upset, or, frankly, very joyous, and it doesn't have to be negative emotion, and not be dysregulated. And, frankly, one could have very little emotion and be dysregulated if one is engaging in a lot of escape and avoidance of that emotion. So this might come out in the wash, but I want to be clear that high emotion does not mean dysregulation. In fact, people who are high on emotionality, like people with BPD typically are still going to be high on emotionality when they're finished with treatment. They're just going to have ways of managing that and handling that so that it's an enjoyable feature of their life instead of a painful, instead of being such an more exclusively painful feature. So when we think about the problems of BPD, things like self-harm, things like chaotic relationships, we can think of those along with substance use disorders, withdrawal, social withdrawal, depression, panic attacks, even dissociation, as maladaptive behaviors that function primarily to regulate emotion. In other words, when a person engages in a suicide attempt or a non-suicidal self-injury, using drugs, dissociating, angry outbursts towards loved ones, all of those things actually can be understood as functioning to bring arousal down or prevent arousal from going up to painful levels. Some of the other problems, such as fears of abandonment, are natural consequences of chronic dysregulation. If I'm chronically dysregulated, that makes my relationships tough, and I probably experience abandonment. And, of course, if I have got tough time, I have high affiliation needs, and I have a lot of lost relationships, I'm going to start to fear abandonment more. It's a natural consequence of being chronically dysregulated. Now, we have a transactional model that we use that talks about the ongoing transaction between an individual's vulnerability to dysregulation and how other people respond to that person and how each of those influences the other. So if I'm vulnerable to being dysregulated, that means that I have certain characteristics that then have an impact on you. And then partly influenced by what I'm doing, you respond back to me. Now, part of your response is also your history, what you bring and your temperament, but part of it's what I'm doing. And then how you respond back to me influences my level of emotion regulation, dysregulation, my vulnerability, my arousal, and so forth. Now, that's the simple version, and here's a slightly more complicated version. So let me walk through this. And I want to point out that when we talk about dysregulation, I want to say this is a very ordinary process, and I suspect that there's nobody in this room who doesn't get dysregulated from time to time. That's pretty ordinary. A dysregulation disorder or problems of pervasive dysregulation is the hallmark of BPD. It's the chronicity, the intensity, the frequency of the dysregulation that makes it BPD, as opposed to just your best friend who, when somebody something bad happens to you, they say, "He did what? I can't believe it!" And you love that because it's, you know, really supportive. Okay, that's maybe a little dysregulated, but you kind of like it because they're only dysregulated in a sense of being supportive. Anyway, so here's what happens. We go through the day or the night, and events happen. Events, that's the little green box. That's where we start. And these events are anything that to an individual has an emotional valence, okay? That it's got some emotion property, as we talk about it in behavioral language. It's got properties of emotionality to it. Now, what that means, of course, is that the events are subjective. Okay, what might be an event for one person is not an event for another person. Okay, think about sensitivity, hearing sensitivity, right? Sometimes you can hear something, if you've got good sensitive hearing, that somebody else can't, right? Sitting in a restaurant with my wife, she says, did you hear what they just said? I said, huh? Who? Where? No idea. Okay, and she's got this whole conversation she's picked up on, very interesting. And she's mentalizing them, not me, unfortunately, at that moment, but, you know, that's okay. And, you know, so there's a kind of sense, so those are emotional events maybe for her, okay, but not for me. I'm not sensitive to it. I don't hear it, okay? So in an emotional situation, right, some people are more emotionally sensitive. They're going to pick things up that other people don't have. It doesn't mean that those things aren't there. It means they aren't there for other people. They're there. There's a phenomenon there. There's something there that some people are picking up to responding to and other people don't. So anyway, the event happens, and when it's an emotional event, by definition, see the big arrow that goes straight down, there's some kind of emotional arousal. Just by definition, if it's an emotional event, there's an emotional response. Now, that's one source of arousal, but notice there are other arrows coming there. The other one comes from high emotion vulnerability. That's temperamental factors like how sensitive to emotion stimuli, how reactive we are to those stimuli, how long it takes us to bring our arousal down, but also present biological factors like, did we get enough sleep? Do we have the flu? Am I restricting my eating? Am I binge eating? Did somebody yell at me this morning? Did somebody give me a nice hug this morning? Those kinds of things all influence my base rate of arousal. And what we know now is that people with BPD walk around with higher levels of base rate arousal. Okay, so there's more vulnerability. There may be more sensitivity. There may be more reactivity. There may be slower return to baseline. There's more high base rate. That's one factor that contributes to emotionality. But then judgments are another, and that's a specific kind of way of appraising the event in some ways. Like, and these, I think I agree with Anthony, that most of the time these are interpersonal events. You know, what happens? You know, gee, you just did this, then you're a jerk, okay? That transforms the energy, the emotional arousal, into something else. It adds intensity and transforms the quality of the emotion. But it also could be, gee, as our arousal goes up, we actually become more judgmental. That's actually pretty good evidence for that. That's what we do. Under higher states of emotion arousal, even people who are not very chronically dysregulated start to engage in what we typically would call it black or white thinking. Things become all or none, good or bad, okay? And that contributes to further arousal. Now, when arousal gets high enough, okay? Now, high enough, again, it may be high. It's high for that person. At the level at which that person becomes uncomfortable, if you don't have much comfort with emotion at all, it might be a rather, relatively speaking, low level of arousal that you want to escape and avoid. If you have a lot of emotion, you have a lot of comfort with emotion, it might be a rather high level of arousal that you want to escape or avoid. But regardless, expression becomes inaccurate. Okay, so if I'm waiting to have coffee with a friend, my friend is late, now that might be an emotional event for me. I might notice it, and I might be a little worried. Well, it was my friend. Maybe this is an ordinary thing for him or her to do. Or I might just be disappointed because, gee, we only have 20 minutes to have coffee and 10 minutes has passed and I'm disappointed. I was looking forward to seeing you. Okay? So there's some emotion there. Okay? We call those primary emotions. But if I start thinking, gosh, what a jerk, you know, kind of pissing away our 20 minutes here, you know, this is, well, all of a sudden, that judgment jacks up my arousal. Instead of disappointment and worry, I'm angry. Okay? Or I might think, you know, you don't love me anymore. And gosh, people don't love me. I'm just kind of a bad person. Bad person. Now I'm feeling kind of embarrassed, kind of ashamed of myself. I've transformed that emotion again. And then when you show up, okay, if I'm just kind of this weepy blob, okay, it's very hard to validate my disappointment and my worry because you don't see the disappointment and worry. Or if I say, why did I bother waiting for you? Okay, what a jerk you are, some friend you are showing up late. It's very hard for you to say, I love you too, I missed you too. It's very hard to do that. Okay, so that inaccurate expression sets up invalidating responses. And of course, you know what happens when you get invalidated, right? Okay, so this is part of it. All right, so, should I finish that? Oh, and of course, if this happens a lot, it contributes to, you know, you go up on the upper right-hand side, the invalidation happens a lot, then there's what we call a pervasive invalidating environment or pervasive invalidating responses, which, of course, make the person more vulnerable, more sensitive. If you've ever been in, anybody ever been in a relationship that didn't end well, like a romantic relationship, that didn't, anybody done that? We're having problems with honesty here in the room. Okay. I'm going to assume that I just triggered some emotion in you. Okay, just think about the week before that relationship that didn't end well. Think about the week before it ended. The other person walks into the room. What happens to your emotion? They don't have to do anything. They walk into the room. They're not making a face. There's no failure to mentalize. It's just a stimulus, okay? What happens? Up it goes, right? That's a kind of hypersensitivity, okay? Now, think about when you started that relationship and they walked into the room. Different, right? Really different. That's all this means. This means that over time, that invalidating responses have an impact on our what triggers us and how we get triggered, how much, in what direction. And if it's pervasive enough, if it's enough relationships, then in fact we become hypersensitized and it becomes more generalized. Okay, so let's talk about DBT and how DBT addresses this. Okay, now first of all, in DBT is not just a psychotherapy. There is psychotherapy in DBT, what we would traditionally think of as psychotherapy, one-on-one kind of stuff, but there's actually more to it. We actually have five different things we're trying to accomplish in DBT, and from the patient's perspective, there are at least three key, maybe four key different components to that. Okay, and one of those is we're trying to help people learn skills, actually how to manage their emotion, how to be more self-aware, how to be more aware of others, okay, mindfulness, emotion regulation, how to interact more effectively with other people, interpersonal skills, how to react to themselves more effectively, self-validation, but also how not to make things worse while all those other things are getting better, distress tolerance. And sometimes medicines are used to facilitate that process. As Seth mentioned, of course, there are no medicines that actually treat BPD, and occasionally there are medicines that actually help with different pieces of that puzzle. So one piece is skills training. We usually do that in groups for efficiency, but it's however we can teach people skills. We teach them skills. We also work on their motivation to use the skills. And that's, we call that individual therapy typically, where we're trying to do an analysis of, gee, where did that lack of skill get you into trouble, especially focusing on emotion, and what could we do differently the next time that happens? With lots of very carefully timed warmth and validation, but lots of push for change. This is the dialectic. Lots of focus on change. How can you do it differently? With lots of acceptance and validation, despite the fact that it makes sense why you did it the way you did it and why it's hard to change. We also figure that people need a boost, that what we do in the session will not necessarily automatically transfer into the rest of their life. And even if it does, it might transfer faster and more efficiently if we facilitate it explicitly. So we actually have between-session contact with patients, sometimes on telephone or email or texting. Sometimes that between-session contact is facilitated by lots of practice and planning for these things. So explicitly taking what we just did here, how can you do that out there? Okay, so some of generalization isn't telephone coaching. Some of it's actually just explicitly moving what happens in the therapy room out to the person's life. We also have a consultation team wherein we allow therapists to stay kind of sane and balanced in this process, to continue to like and enjoy working with their patients, and also to get a second opinion, because this is a dialectical idea, the idea that, you know, gee, there's more than one way to think about this, and so to get other people's opinions and pushing for more acceptance or more change. And we also will intervene directly in the patient's social and family environment with family therapy and other kinds of interventions to help things work better out in the world. Now, if we understand DBT outcomes, we have to think, gee, there might be many reasons why DBT outcomes are what they are. One of them could be the structure, the fact that we have multiple functions, multiple contact points, actually multiple providers. There's an individual therapist, but then there are people in skill training. There might be people on the telephone from time to time. There are all kinds of things that happen. There's a treatment team. That might have something to do with the outcomes. Maybe. We don't know. We've never done a study where we take the consultation team out of DBT and see if it works as well. Frankly, that's because DBT therapists don't want to do that. They value that part of it. There are also meta processes that could be responsible for outcomes, things like dialectics, like the combination of acceptance and change, the combination of validation and problem solving. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's being able to do both. Maybe that helps people learn that flexibility. I'm not as skilled on PowerPoint as Anthony, but when he's going back and forth with his slide, my mind is going, oh, that's flexibility. That's being able to do what's needed in a given situation and having a, I'm thinking like a DBT therapist, like a broad repertoire of response skills. But maybe that dialectic is important, being able to develop, geez, in this situation, I can't really change it, so I'll work on accepting it. Maybe in this situation I can change it, and since I don't like it, I will change it. Maybe that ability to move back and forth between these polarities is pretty important. But we also have meta-targeting, things that we're always trying to work on, which is help people regulate themselves, to stay regulated, to re-regulate, and to see themselves as empowered, that, gee, if I can't do it this time, I'll do it next time. I can learn how to do what I need to do to manage my life and build the life that I want. And, of course, there could be very specific therapeutic processes. So while I'm going to talk about those therapeutic processes, and I think a lot of our discussions in comparing MBT to DBT will focus on this last piece, the specific therapeutic processes, I don't want to ignore these other things that actually are very relevant to DBT. Now, this core dialectic of acceptance and change is very important. The idea is that on the one hand, it looks like acceptance and change look like very different ideas, like they're opposites, like they're incompatible. And the whole idea of the dialectic is the synthesis of opposites. How can things that apparently seem to be incompatible, how can we make them compatible? So we do a lot of that. The two poles here are, on the one hand, a technology of change, behavior therapy strategies, problem solving, rationality, logic, being experimental. All the things we do in behavior therapy like contingency management and exposure and stimulus control, skill training. But also on the other side, acceptance-oriented or mindfulness practice, which has to do with validation and understanding and observing and knowing experientially, recognizing that there are just existing paradoxes in the world, and learning through experience, not just through logic and rationality. So let's just look at the change strategies that we have. There's behavior therapy. It's just standard behavior therapy, behavioral assessment, not getting stuck in mental constructs. Not that that couldn't be useful, but that's not what we focus on, behavioral assessment. By the way, behavior and behavior therapy is anything a person does that can be observed by anybody. So it's your thinking is a behavior, and your feeling is a behavior, your sensations are behaviors, and your actions are behaviors. They're all relevant, and they're all understood to be learnable. We can learn them, we can relearn them, we can condition them, we can purposefully or automatically learn to do things differently. So, and we use different strategies like teaching people skills. You know, if you think about motivation, we often think about like what gets you to do what you do. And so if you take my youngest child, I got four children, but, you know, now he can swim pretty well. But when he was, say, three and he didn't swim, if we put him out in the middle of the, you know, 10 feet out in the lake or in the middle of the deep end in the swimming pool, and we said, okay, come over here. Come to daddy. Come to mommy. Come visit your brothers and your sister. Here's your favorite toy. We'll make you pesto for dinner. That's his favorite food. So even at three, what can I say? And, you know, what did he do? Glug, 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 right? There's no skill, right? It's not a lack of motivation in the sense of wanting, but no skill. And so we want to be careful in DBT not to assume that there's a motivational deficit when it's actually a skill deficit. We don't want to say, gee, he didn't really want to swim to the side of the pool. He just wasn't ready. We want to teach him how to swim. We don't want him to drown. So skill training is important. Stimulus control, that's having to do with the conditioning of stimuli. What elicits what? We can recondition things. Contingency management, we learn through what works and what doesn't work. That shapes our behavior. Exposure and response prevention, sometimes things are maladaptively learned. We want to recondition them so that they're not so maladaptive anymore. And we use acceptance and validation which in modern behavior therapy is a part of behavior therapy. It used to be all change all the time, but now it's acceptance and change all the time, one or the other, or both. We're always doing these things in the service of helping the person become more skillful in their lives, to empower them to be able to take on any situation they encounter and be able to handle it in a way that's self-respecting and effective in meeting the goals of their life, a life worth living. Skills are solutions. Skill training and skill generalization are the ways that we accomplish that. We have skill sets in DBT like mindfulness and interpersonal skills that I mentioned, and these are designed to supplant skill deficits, the things that go into DBT. So instead of, for example, being with an impulsive urge to, say, engage in self-harm, we help the person first tolerate distress. So now the urge goes down, and then it's not the end of the story, that's the beginning of the story, then move to regulating emotion to be able to manage the situation better, move to interpersonal skills to build better relationships in that same situation, self-validation and self-acceptance, so to diminish self-loathing and judgments about self and so forth, and mindfulness to be able to then be successfully in their own skin, in their own life. That's the idea. So there's a lot of things here that get carried through. This is a little map of what this might look like. So in this particular case, each of these links is a behavior. It's a thought. It's a feeling. Okay, it's an action. It's something somebody else does that's in the presence of the person. Okay, so in the beginning, we have some vulnerabilities. That could be temperamental. That could be something that just happened. It could be biological, like I haven't eaten, you know, or I've had not enough sleep or whatever it might be. And then something happens. There's some prompting event. Okay? These are often social. Often it could be something like being criticized or invalidated, or it could be the absence of something, like, gee, I'm longing to do something and I have no friends. And so that's a social event too. It's a lack of social event, but it's a social event. Something happens, and then there's some emotional response. So the something happens is here, the prompting event. And then this piece is a normative, justifiable emotional response. Okay? In other words, lots of people would have that response. So if I've got plans, what's today, Friday? It's Friday night. I've got plans to meet a friend I haven't seen for a long time, and he and I are going to go to dinner and hang out. And really, I don't have a lot of other friends, so this is really my highlight of my weekend. And he phones me up and says, gee, you know, I got the flu, I can't come. Okay, how do I feel? It's not a trick question, I promise. How do I feel?
Sad,
disappointed, exactly. Pretty. You don't have to know me to know that, right? You just have to be a human being, okay? You know that. Okay, now, that's not a problem, okay? Now, if I go this way, okay, I don't just manage my sadness. If I manage my sadness, I'm going this way. This is what we're trying to help people do. But here, what happens is I get maybe, I'll just as an example, I might get judgmental. Maybe I get judgmental of him. He's so unreliable. You know, what kind of friend would do this? You know, I haven't seen him in months. I've got nothing else to do this weekend. What a jerk, okay? Now, I'm jacking up my emotion. I have judgments. It leads to anger. Then maybe after a while being angry, I start saying, well, gee, what's wrong with me? What kind of friend am I? I'm judging my poor friend who's got the flu. I'm a bad person. And I kind of twitch in this for a while, and then, you know, emotion is so high, and I can't stand it, and then I engage in some problem behavior. I drink. I try to kill myself. Who knows what I do. So the idea in DBT is to block the dysfunction there, or here, or here, or even here, when it's possible, and instead get the person to use skills. Like, what would you do? You're disappointed. What would you do? Well, call somebody else. Now, that's very skillful because you're assuming that the call somebody else is way down here. In here, you got to manage the sadness. So what you probably do is allow yourself to feel a little bit disappointed, feel a little sad. You probably allow it. You wouldn't react to it. Right? You're kind of a regulated person. You can tolerate having that bit of sadness. Okay? And you might not get judgmental. You might describe the situation. Say, gee, it makes sense. If he's got the flu, that makes sense. Okay? Now, that's a kind of mentalizing process. That's what we call relationship mindfulness that might be important. And then, of course, there might be a dozen. There might be a dozen other skills, but then leads to, in fact, you know, something else. Like I get to either have a nice evening by myself or I call somebody else and do something with somebody else. Okay, so in DBT, we're always interested in understanding the emotion on the chain. That's our focal point. So it gets more complicated. There's emotion always here. And then you see this is the therapist. The green light therapist is supporting these things. The red light therapist, does that sound good? That doesn't sound good. The stoplight therapist, the stoplight therapist. Let's go with that. The stoplight therapist is trying to block these things and redirect to more skillful alternatives. The therapist is trying to block these things in the session and get the person to practice these things in the session in order to make a plan to be able to do these things out of session, very overtly, very explicitly. Lots of generalization to transfer those skills to the relevant situation through rehearsal and planning and sometimes phone consultation, and for people to be able to manage crises, well, obviously to have fewer crises, but in the beginning to manage them more effectively without escalating as far and without external intervention, which sometimes, sadly, sometimes actually reinforces the dysfunction. So we have acceptance and validation strategies, which are a very important piece of this. We have change strategies we just ripped through. I want to talk just a little bit about validation strategies. Now, in DBT, Marshall Linehan has outlined that there are different ways to validate that are appropriate in different situations. Some of these are common across psychotherapies. Others are more specific to different kinds of therapies. In DBT, we use them all. Now, one of these, staying awake, okay, that also means literally staying awake, okay. Famous family therapist Carl Whitaker, in his later years, he would fall asleep in a session and then wake up and interpret his dream to the family that he was treating. That's not DBT. You have to literally stay awake to do DBT, but it's more like awake to what's happening in the moment. Okay, that's a kind of mindfulness. So unbiased. I'm here. I'm paying attention. I'm just alert and awake to what you're doing. Okay, I would have to say that I have never seen a therapy that's explicitly said that's a bad thing to do. Okay, I think therapies say this is a good thing to do. The second one is the Saturday Night Live version of psychotherapy. What I hear you saying is, or you stroke your chin. Of course, it doesn't have to look like that. It could be quite genuine, like, oh, gee, you look sad. Okay, that's accurate reflection. Person comes in and they got a long face. Oh, gee, you look sad. And then what happened? Okay. Or the person says, I had a really hard day. And then you say, yeah, you look like you did. That's reflection. It doesn't have to be. It's not parroting back. It's reflecting your what you understand about the person's experience. Now, that's the essence of validation. It's communicating the essence of what we understand about the other person's experience. Okay? Now, number three is... Now, number two, most therapies do. Number three is also present in most psychotherapies, where sometimes the therapist articulates a hypothesis about what the patient's experience might be or is about to be or was that the patient isn't actually saying, isn't describing. Remember that inaccurate expression we talked about? This is one of those situations where we see something that says X, but we're guessing that it's Y, and we tender that as an offer. Gee, in these situations, and it might be, gee, if that situation, I would feel this. So, for example, I had a patient not so long ago whose dog died. The beloved dog companion for 15 years, okay? Beloved, you know, dog, really only companion. And when she came in and she was furious, and she's just like, you know, I'm going to sue the veterinarian. And just a string of expletives about the veterinarian. And after all, I said, you know, gosh, I can see that you're angry. Okay, I can see that you're angry. Accurate reflection. And I said, you know, but gosh, you know, I would be so sad. I mean, this dog, if I had a companion for 15 years, it just died, I'd be really sad. Then she burst into tears. Yes, I'm really sad. Okay, so that accurate reflection, accurate guessing, hypothesis about her experience that she wasn't really aware of at that moment or was fighting to be aware of actually helped her to come back to that experience. That's pretty common in psychotherapy in general. Now, level four validation, I think, is also pretty common. That's when we say your experience makes sense given something specific about you or your experiences. Okay? like something specific about you, your biology, or your experiences, your history, okay? So if I was in a car accident, okay, last week I wasn't, but if I had been in a car accident, and I got in a car with you, and you're driving very safely in a very safe car, in a very safe way, in a non-dangerous way, and I'm gripping the door handle and sweating, what do you say to me? In what way does it make sense that I'm so anxious? Exactly. It makes sense. Given that I just had a car accident, it makes sense that I'm anxious. You don't say, yeah, my driving is awful. I understand why you're anxious. You know, you don't say that because that's not true. Your driving is fine. I'm anxious because of this experience. Okay? Now, of course, in psychotherapy, it's sometimes very recent things, but oftentimes we're interpreting things based on, early learning, early in the case of mentalizing, it's early attachment. In the case of DBT, it's often, sort of being misunderstood and invalidated or just not feeling like you fit, okay? So those are interpretations in some way. But what they're saying is they're making a distinction between your behavior, feelings, thoughts, experience, actions, don't make sense given what's currently going on right in the moment. They make sense based on something that's happened in the past, some prior experiences. Whereas number five says, your experience makes perfect sense right here for anybody, right? Remember, I said, my friend didn't come. How do I feel? You said disappointed. And so if I came and I said, oh, I'm so disappointed, my friend, I was really looking forward. I only get to see him every once in a while. And, here I am in New Haven, and he lives here, and I was going to have dinner with him, and he's got the flu, so I can't see him. I'd say, oh, I'm just so disappointed. You would say, exactly. You say, of course. Like, you don't interpret that saying, well, your early attachment deficits make you hypersensitive. You say, anybody'd be disappointed in that situation. That's the level five. And I suspect that some therapists would do that. Okay? Okay. And then, of course, there's this pervasive kind of radical genuineness, this idea that we're not going to treat the patient as fragile. As an ordinary human being, full of respect, just as much a valid human being as I am, and so I'm going to treat this person like I would treat my brother or sister. I'm not going to treat them as fragile, and so forth. And you'll see some of that this afternoon. We also sometimes just do things that are validating. Like if you come home and somebody you live with says they're cold, you might get them a blanket, instead of saying, gee, I can see that you're cold. Or, gee, if I had your temperament, your thermostat, I'd be cold too. You get them a blanket. Okay, now I want to talk about the therapeutic alliance for a minute because I think this is an interesting thing. So we did this recent study comparing DBT to an object relations treatment. And what we found was that the working alliance, which is reported by the patient about the therapist and the therapy, okay, that the working alliance is higher in DBT, significantly higher at all points. So obviously DBT patients are experiencing this in a pretty pleasant way. But I have to say that the psychodynamic condition, the red line is actually pretty typical of psychotherapy in general, so this is not bad. This is not a bad set of scores. But for whatever reason, and a little bit surprising to me, DBT patients actually reported higher alliance. They actually liked their therapist. They felt cared about and so forth. What's interesting, of course, is, well, gee, how does alliance relate to outcome? Everybody knows that, gee, the quality of the therapeutic alliance has something to do with outcome. Well, indeed, over the whole size of the study, suicide attempts and self-injury, modest relationship, 0.3, ideation, 0.4, depression, 0.4, in the expected directions, right? Better alliance at the end of better alliance during treatment, better outcomes at the end of treatment, fewer suicide attempts, less suicidal ideation, less depression. But if you look at this separately by treatment condition, you get a very different picture. What it says is that even though the alliance was better for DBT patients, that it actually had nothing to do with their outcomes. In the psychodynamic treatment, where the alliance was pretty good but not as good, it actually had a lot to do with outcomes. So, for example, suicide attempts and self-injuries were related at 0.5 in the psychodynamic condition and a non-significant, essentially zero in DBT. Ideation, 0.7 in psychodynamic condition, essentially zero in DBT. 0.5 for depression, essentially zero for DBT. So what does this mean, do you think? I think it means that the therapeutic alliance is related to outcome. First of all, descriptively, it is related to outcome in psychodynamic psychotherapy, but not in DBT. So alliance overall is not what's mediating outcome in general. What I think it means is that there are different pathways, that there's more than one way to get there for patients, that some patients might benefit from one kind of therapy and other patients might benefit from a different kind of therapy. But then in DBT, we don't explicitly work on the relationship as a goal, although we're explicitly working within the relationship as an effective means all the time. So let's just talk for a couple of minutes about this idea of validation. Now, this is what I fondly refer to as my grandmother study, okay? My grandmother's been dead for 20 years. Excuse me, 30 years. I'm getting old. 30 years. And she would have said, I knew this. You didn't need to do a study to figure this out. They pay you to do this? That's what she would have said. In the fondest way, okay? And yeah, they do pay us to do this. It's kind of nice. It's a good job. Okay. What we did is we stressed people out, okay? We stressed them out. We're psychologists. I was chair of the ethics board at the time. That might have something to do with this. But anyway, so you can get away with stuff. We stressed them out. Actually, these are volunteers who know they're going to be stressed out. We say, we're going to put you under stress, but we want to interested in responses to stress. Everybody gets stressed out. We just give them math problems that they can't solve. That's all. That's the stressor. Okay, so it's not, I mean, they look easy. They're just addition, but they're actually hard. We do them in a way that they cognitively can't do, like put them in rows and columns. You can't do it. And if they have anybody got the right answer, we said it was wrong, too. But that's another story. But, okay, so you're with, there's a little sadistic streak here going, just a little. Okay, but to be fair, nobody got the right answer. Okay, nobody did. But we were prepared to give them tell them they were wrong. Anyway, but what they didn't know was that they'd been randomly assigned after they were stressed out to be validated or invalidated by the experimenter. So the experimenter would say, okay, after a few trials, get the wrong answer, wrong answer, wrong answer. Okay, gee, how's this going? And invariably, the subject would say, gosh, this is frustrating. I don't like this. This is much harder than I thought. Or they might say something self-invalidating, like, I feel stupid. I'm embarrassed. I didn't do better. And in the validating condition, the experimenter would make good eye contact and then kind of gently smile, gentle face, make eye contact, and say, yeah, of course. You know, everybody responds that way. That's, in fact, this is designed to be stressful. That's the whole point. Everybody responds that way. Okay. And then give them three more math problems that they would get wrong. And then, you know, validate them again. And then again and again. Okay. And as you can see, the green line shows that despite the stress, with validation, they come back down. Two-thirds of their arousal goes down. And the arousal here is measured both by self-report, but also psychophysiologically, galvanic skin response, heart rate reactivity, and respiratory monitoring. In the invalidating condition, the experimenter would ask the same question, how's it going? They say, oh, it's frustrating, I don't like this. The experimenter would then look down without smile, look back up, say, huh. Pause. Most people don't respond that way. It's just an experiment. And then move on, okay? And then give them three more math problems, and then invalidate them again, and see what happens. They can't get used to it. The stressor stays up. So this is like coming home at the end of the day, and you had a crappy day. If you get validated, it helps you let go of it. If you get invalidated, you hang on to it. You hang on to the arousal. So my grandmother was very wise. That's the take-home message here. All right, so if we understand validation in DBT, we have to understand that it's not the same as being supportive. Sometimes it is supportive, but it's not the same. It could be warm, but it isn't always. And it has multiple functions. It's not a non-specific intervention. It's a very specific intervention, in part because the temporal sequences matter, okay, in the sense that we're validating valid experiences in the ways that they're valid, okay? I'm sweating and anxious in the car not because you're a bad driver, not because there's any present danger. I'm sweating and anxious in the car because I had a car accident last week. So you validate that I am anxious and the reason for it, but you don't validate the invalid, not because you're a bad driver or because it's dangerous. So in DBT, we're using validation as a kind of discrimination training. Validating the valid in the ways that you got to say this, by the way, to leave and get lunch, you got to say this three times fast. You got to say, validate the valid in the ways that it's valid. Don't invalidate the invalid. And don't invalidate. I get no lunch. What can I say? Don't invalidate the invalid and don't. No, excuse me. Don't invalidate the valid and don't validate the invalid. Okay? Now, Validation of the valid, that's acceptance, sets up invalidation of the invalid. Okay? Invalid things are invalid. We've got to invalidate those. We just don't want to invalidate valid things. We don't want to validate invalid things. Okay. I redeemed myself. Okay. This is not DBT. And for those of you who like this one, there's a whole little thing on YouTube about a guy who does this, and everybody loves him. But all right, so the dialectics of validation are that the same behavior can have both valid and invalid parts, and in DBT, we're trying to sort those out. Okay, every behavior is valid in some way. Some are just valid ontologically. Okay, others are valid because of limited history, like the car accident. Others are normatively valid. Anybody would feel that way. And others are valid only because they would work, not for any other reason. So we can think about validation as a shaping kind of thing, because sometimes validation serves a function as a reinforcer. But sometimes it blocks one thing while pushing towards another. Okay, validation, yes and. And sometimes it's an eliciting stimulus. It pulls for something. Actually, I notice something and I validate it before you've said anything, and it pulls for you to attend to that, and it pulls you in that direction. For those of you who are behaviorally oriented, that's the discriminative stimulus, but there's also these things we call S deltas, which means that, you know, some stimuli elicit not behaving, like a phone that's not ringing, right? You don't answer it, right? You know you don't answer the, I mean, once you're past 2 years old, you know you don't answer the phone that's not ringing. So a non-ringing phone is an S delta. A ringing phone is an SD. You don't have to do it, but it's a stimulus. It's like there's something there if you do it with an SD. There's nothing there if you do it with an S-delta. And so ultimately, it's discrimination training, trying to get people to be more mindful of some aspects of their experience and the world around them, and less attention to other things, more acceptance and more emotion regulation. So we're helping to discriminate primary from secondary emotions, judgments from descriptions. He's a jerk from, gee, he's got the flu and isn't here, and I'm sad about that. Self-invalidation from self-validation. I'm a jerk. Okay, that's self-invalidation. Instead of, gee, it makes sense that I'm disappointed. Okay. What's my experience versus your experience? Okay. I'm mindful of mine. I'm mindful that I don't know what yours is, or I'm mindful that I'm imagining what yours is, and that this is that perspective taking. Okay. That doubt that Anthony talked about this morning. And relationship mindfulness from inaccuracy, okay? That's part of it. Like, I know that you hate me, as opposed to, gee, I've got the thought that you hate me, but I don't know what you do, okay? Being able to act skillfully from that. Now, what that means is, and I'm not going to go through all these, because I think we're going to demonstrate these this afternoon, but there are a lot of ways that we can respond when a patient expresses some emotion, or a belief, or a thought, or something. We can validate it in very many different ways, but we can also not validate it if it's not valid, or we can block it if it's not valid. Okay? There are a lot of things we do with validation, including invalidation, and ultimately, the dialectics of validation is, I think, what we're doing in DBT. We're constantly sorting. We want to validate things that are valid in the ways that they're valid, and then we want to block the things that aren't valid, and try to create another thing that's more valid and validate that in the way that it's valid, all the while trying not to step off this very thin tightrope into invalidating the valid or validating the invalid in ways that they're invalid. Don't worry. It'll all make sense. All right. So we're trying to maybe have the therapist respond to the accuracy of what the patient is expressing. Okay, and this is what I just said. Validate the valid, block the invalid, redirect, use warmth and soothing to promote skills. So go ye forth and validate. But only valid things in the way that they're valid, and block and redirect everything else. Okay, thanks.
We have time for a few questions. I'm expecting we're going to have more questions than we'll be able to take at this time, and some of the questions will go later following either the role play demonstrations or the panel discussions. We have one question. In DBT, you talked about heightened emotional sensitivity. The two questions related, does DBT or do you see this as a consequence of early maltreatment that was adaptive in the context? And maladaptive in other contexts. is heightened emotion sensitivity in borderline personality disorder viewed as increased sensitivity to detecting emotions that are actually present in others? Okay, there's a lot going on in this question.
It's a great question, and I have to say that everything I'm going to say about this is speculative. There are no longitudinal studies that inform how you get from point A as an infant or a toddler, and we really have to start with infancy because there's so much learning that's happened by the time you get to be one, okay? You got to start, you know, there's nothing that tells us, that informs us. So this is all theory. It's all concept. But the transactional model is really quite subtle. The idea, you know, when we talk about biological predisposition, it's not out of context. It's disposition to be sensitive in the environment in which that person actually is living. So if I've got one person as a parent, okay, person A, I might have my level of sensitivity might actually not get tweaked by parent A, but might get tweaked by parent B. Okay, so we wouldn't say in DBT that I've got a biological predisposition to sensitivity. I've got a biological predisposition to developing sensitivity in a certain environment. Okay, that's the matching mismatching. Okay, not that it's some generic kind of thing. And I you know, the idea. So, in fact, there's evidence for this. For example, adoptive kids, even who were not maltreated, adopted from birth, have higher rates of BPD than non-adoptive kids. Now, there's not any huge risk factor there, okay? But there's about twice the rate. So, I mean, the vast majority of kids who are adopted don't develop BPD. But the point is that, you know, if I'm kind of sensitive and I have a parent who's kind of sensitive, whatever that means, okay? There's matching, and so my parent knows what's going on with me and is responding to me in ways that actually attenuate my sensitivity or whatever those phenomena are. Whereas if I don't match well with my parent, okay, my sensitivity gets exacerbated by my parent. Okay, my parent might be sensitive to other things, may not be maltreating in any way, but just is a mismatch for my temperament. And that very iterative process over thousands and thousands and thousands of tiny little transactions, we shape each other. Okay, and biology gets shaped here. So, I mean, when Seth was talking about the biology, don't forget that's the biology of adults once they've got BPD. It doesn't mean that they had that biology going on in the brain and that caused BPD. That just means that's co-occurring. That's just a brain level of analysis of telling us what's going on in the brain when the person is dysregulated. And that's all. It doesn't mean that it caused. The cause here is much more complex, I believe.
We have a question from parents who have a daughter who struggled for a long time with very severe depression, has tried many treatments, including ECT and medications. And the question comes to, what else is available to lift the depression enough so that she can apply her DBT skills?
Well, that's a really good question. I would say that within DBT, we are treating depression too. I mean, almost everybody in DBT, almost every patient also, comes in and out of major depressive, you know, just gets more and less depressed. And so the short answer, and I know this is going to be satisfying because obviously it's not happening, but DBT, inside DBT, there should be ongoing treatment to alleviate depression and seeing that as a process through depression gets a little better and then the person's able to do other things, which of course help the depression get a little better. It should happen right inside the treatment. It's not as though there's some other treatment that ought to work. Now, honestly, I mean, the thing about DBT is it varies in its quality and in people's training and how sophisticated they are. There are people who just offer DBT skills training groups and say that's DBT, and it's not DBT. DBT is much more, unfortunately, complicated than that.
What if the person did not know you had that car accident? Can you comment on that?
If they didn't,
scenario?
Then that's a great question. What if the person didn't know I had the car accident? Then you see how that's inaccurate expression on my part? All I'm expressing is anxiety in a situation that's not dangerous. There's no expression, there's no clear, the person doesn't understand it, and I'm very likely to get invalidated. The person's very likely, much more likely at that moment than to feel like I'm judging their driving. I'm responding to their driving. And it's much more likely to say, gosh, why are you so sensitive? You know, was something wrong with my driving, kind of defensively, you know, and actually invalidate. If I say, gosh, no, I had this car, the person is much more able to be validating and soothing.
Can you give the reference for the DBT object relations study?
It's under review. It's not been published yet.
There are more questions, which we will bring to Dr. Frizzetti. Thank you, Alan. Wonderful. We are going to be moving on to our...
Thank you.